Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host,
Miguel.
And he is my co-DM, for we are both DMs, GMs, Dungeon Masters, Game Masters.
Whole Meisters.
We run role-playing games, and storytellers, etc. We run role-playing games, or we've run role-playing games. Yeah, we still run role-playing games, but we have run role-playing games as well. And we're going to tell you stories about them. That's what we do on this podcast. And then we glean advice and ideas and tips and just sort of discuss everything we've done. It is episode 70, and it is the 15th of July, 2021. And, I don't know. Who's going first this time? What do we got this time? I am finally moving into, like, beyond the sort of intro phase of my latest act set in the necro-supremacist Nightside Eclipse realm of Citra Arha. Which I'll be getting into what the hell that's all about, but...
Necro hell, right?
Sort of. That's I think the comparison there came from you saying that my depiction of Citra Arha seemed to be more freakish and hellish than my depiction of hell had been.
That's right.
But hell had been at least predefined for me in the form of the lair that I was using as existing as an already in the context of Dungeons and Dragons. But whereas Citra Arha, I just got to sort of let my imagination run wild and do whatever kind of crazy, freakish, undead experiments I could think of.
And it should really come as a surprise to no one that Tom's idea of hell is more hellish than D&D's idea of hell.
It's not even really my idea of hell. It's just, I don't know, it's the night side. It's the place where all the undead necro-supremacists come from and their horrible interdimensional faction, what have you. You're keeping it going with the Destiny of Istus?
Yeah, that's right. Following up on that plague business that popped up a few sessions ago, the players are going to try to address that problem as they travel south down to a place called Jurn, which is kind of like the Greyhawk version of Florida. People are a little kooky there, and it's just the climate, and flora and fauna are very sort of Floridian, kind of tropical, nice and sunny. They've gone all the way from the barren ice wastes of Stonehold down to the tropical climes of Jurn.
You ever go to Florida?
Yeah, I went to Florida when I was a kid. My family went to Disney World. And
you ever see any gators or nothing?
Yeah, I did. I saw, you know what? It's the best thing. I saw gators at a mini putt course.
Oh, neat. I went to, my family went to some big old, swamp reserve park, whatever, see gators. Look at gators. Look at big turtles and stuff.
Did you ride one of those fan boats?
No, didn't get to do that.
Disappointing.
Honestly, my primary experience of Florida was we got this I guess it's we got in on a timeshare that my grandmother owned or something. It's like there was a place that everybody on my mom's side of the family could vacation to basically in Florida. I think they probably still have it. But we went there and I just remember being like very very bored. Like they, I didn't have
Florida, more like Borida.
Yeah, well, I just remember like because I didn't really have like a computer there or anything. Like I feel like I had my laptop, but like I didn't have anything to like play on, I guess, or something. I don't know. Whatever the case, I just remember that like I had literally there was like basically a big closet that I put my sleeping bag in. And I basically just like lived in this very small square space, this closet, and just kept the door closed and stayed in the dark and had a great time cooped up in my airlock in Florida. And also, I remember riding around in the back of the car going places that I didn't care about. Oh, I remember I got, do you remember I had, I had a ski mask with the face of Heath Ledger's Joker on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that in Daytona. We went to Daytona and there was a mall and I got that and I was like, I'm the only person buying one of these that is not planning to rob somewhere.
Boy, Tom, how old were you when you did that?
Oh, man, I don't know, man. I don't remember.
This really illustrates the age difference between us. When I was in Florida, it was before you even had personal computers. I just had to read books. I remember.
Oh yeah, well,
I remember well, that
you
summer
said when you were a kid. Like this was more recently for me.
That summer, when I was killing time, I didn't lock myself in a closet, but the rental we had. There was a giant stack of Archie comics. I just read a bunch of just milquetoast, mediocre Archie comics all summer.
Yeah. You know, anyways, that now we're deeply off topic. Your characters are going to Florida and I've been living like a goblin in a Florida box. That's the way to do it. Who are we starting with this time?
I don't know. I've lost track of who did it last time.
Me too. I think
maybe the better question is,
I think I went first last time.
I was going to say, do you have some like crazy long act that you need to get through?
Not really, but I think I went first last time.
I guess I'll take it then. So, last time the players just had a little adventure in this free city of Greyhawk, where some of them were trapped in an underground fighting ring, and then Maeve came in and rescued them, and there was a big fight. And the other major plot point was that Maeve had officially been made a paladin of the Order of Istis. They had their sort of, like, knighting ceremony and made her rank official. And so now, shortly after those events, at the start of this adventure, the players receive word that the magical plague known as the Red Death, that they inadvertently sort of unleashed upon the world when they visited Rook Roost, they set free some...
Dangus Mangus.
Yeah, they accidentally set free some infected bats. Man, again, bats bearing the plague. Why does this feel so prescient in 2021? They set free some infected bats, and the bats flew out of
this
the
party
wizard.
Has also had like a real bad run of luck. Like
they
relative
really
to
have.
Other parties, they're like, I don't want to call it a failure rate, but like their misfortune rate is like especially relative. I guess it is a failure rate because it's relative to the number of things they try to take on. Like they tried to assassinate Ralph Seavor.
Okay, so I was about to quip. I was like, but is it
the mystery?
Is it bad luck or is it cruel fate? But no, in the case of trying to assassinate Ralph Seavor, that was all on them. Because, you know, most of this campaign, the idea is that the gods are messing with them. And this adventure in particular that I'm about to describe, like so much of this is just Istis and Yuz toying with the players. And
but, like, does them getting scammed twice over, does that figure into that great conflict.
No, it actually doesn't. That's the funny thing, is because
the thing that's so funny about it is like
they've actually
they just
had
keep
like more success.
Into these terrible blunders.
They've actually had more success with the little assignments and trials that Istis puts them through than they have in just like the mundane scams that they get caught up in, like the romance scam and the magic pop-up ads. So yeah, there was always this like, whoops, we did it again kind of attitude with this group, but it was also pretty funny, and it did make their victories that much sweeter. So I guess what I will say is, before I even give you like the hook, this adventure is another one that I ran directly out of the Fate of Istis campaign module. And if you look at the Fate of Istis campaign module, like, it's just divided up by locations. So you've got Rook Roost, you have Realmord, and then you have Jurn. And when I was running this campaign, basically what I'd do is I'd use these chapters as like sort
Countdown
of
Countdown and Jurner.
Yeah. Jurner. It does have the extraneous R. But I'd basically just treat these as sort of like bottleneck points and then throw in more episodic, disconnected adventures in between. So not everything was on the main campaign track. It was sort of like they'd head towards the next phase of the campaign. But before that, or in between those pieces of the Fate of Istis campaign, I'd throw in other little side adventures and such. And so this one I'm running directly out of the Fate of Istis module. And this is the one where it really like became clear to me that whether or not it was intentional when they wrote the Fate of Istis module, but it really seems like a lot of this is just Istis is messing with the players. Like, the point is for the players to kind of feel like they're being led along by the nose. And so I started to lean into that more and more. I really wanted the players to start going like, you know, wait a minute, isn't it like a little too convenient that this happened? Or isn't it odd how we show up someplace and then everything immediately starts going wrong? Like, I wanted them to start cluing in that they were pawns in some greater game, so that eventually they would sort of go like, this is all just too convenient. This is ridiculous. But the funny thing is that it took them a while, because the fact of D&D is that you are leading them around by the nose. Like, the DM is kind of just acting like Istis would and setting up these little challenges for the party to complete. So it was sort of like a funny side effect. I wanted to make it really obvious that the gods were toying with them, but it still took them a while to clue in, because of the nature of Dungeons and Dragons, where the DM is toying with you by the very nature of the game.
I mean, it's one of the things that works so well about the concept of the campaign of like the gods using the players as pawns, is like, you know, it gamifies the narrative, basically.
Yeah. So for this one, the Order of Istis has received word that there are outbreaks of the plague popping up all across the continent. Small. It hasn't spread like, you know, it'll be a city has developed the plague, but it won't be like a whole swath of the continent yet. And they received word that although there have been these small outbreaks in these regions to the south, the city of Jurn has been completely untouched. And the theory is that the count who lords over the city of Jurn, he's also a cleric, and he has this amulet that is staving off the disease. And so the order is going like, this must be another one of these magic items that are reappearing, you know, sort of coinciding with these major events are all these magic items. Again, part of my motivation here is to sort of create this atmosphere like everything is escalating, everything's ramping up, and we've got these chaotic things that are happening, but we also have like these, you know, objects of power popping up too. It's all going to lead to something big. And so the players, Maeve in particular, but you know, bring your posse, they're all sent down to Jurn to investigate, to see if perhaps this count can help tackle the larger problem of the plague across the continent, or, you know, maybe he'll at least be able to give them the magic item temporarily. See what is going on in Jern. The way that I think the reason it's called Countdown in Jern, this part of the module, is because the way this one is outlined is very much like a series of events where you can set the players free in this location, and then you are given like a schedule where it's like, okay, so on day one, this happens. And then on day two, this happens. And in the afternoon of day three, this happens. And you can just kind of let the players have their downtime and explore the locale and then pepper it with these sort of timed events. And so that is what I did. First, they arrived in Jern, and I just let them sort of explore around. They, this being D&D 3.5, they used their gather information skills to find out more about the city and also about the Count. And the Count is out of town, but he is returning tomorrow afternoon. So they've got to stick around at least until the next day. And this is where I started giving them some downtime. They went to the market.
Just to clarify, they have downtime here, but like they do have an overarching objective as well. Like that I think is pretty crucial when you use these, you know, timed sequence sessions or whatever, is like the players need to have something that they're chasing throughout the session. Otherwise, it like becomes one of those things where it's like a bad horror game where you're just like waiting for the thing to pop out.
Yes, of course. And the main thing they are chasing, though, is like, okay, well, we have to wait until tomorrow to meet with the Count. So they're like, well, why don't we stock up on spell components, or, you know, buy potions or whatever, visit the market. Hulka, of course, is always like, let's find a tavern, let's have a party, that kind of thing. But unbeknownst to the players, they're about to just walk into even more timed events. And so they head to the market, and the first thing that happens is they're perusing, merchants' goods, when these two dogs that are tied up near them start going berserk as a sort of a fat, well-to-do merchant passes by. And they kind of ignore it. Like, I blended it into the background noise, describing everything that's happening. But Stash, the druid, immediately picks up that something's wrong. So she goes over and she talks to the dog, and she goes like, why, what do you have against this guy in particular? And the dogs say, like, this guy smells funny. There's something like really off about him. He has a smell about him like he's carrying a poison or some kind of toxin. And it just really upset these dogs. And that's because, once again, like, the answer to so many things in this adventure is like, it's Morgarath. Morgarath is just like messing with the players throughout this whole thing. In this case, Morgarath is disguised as this merchant named Androch Larogede, and he has a boat in the harbor that he's using as a lair. And the objective here is that Morgarath is like sort of casing the players, getting his eye on them, figuring out what's going on with them, and at various points through this adventure will basically like bump into them or walk past them under different disguises to find out like what are they doing there, what's their objective, and how can Morgarath disrupt their plans. So first, he's in the form of this merchant. The players follow him and, you know, notice that he gets onto this boat in the harbor, and they sort of take note so that they can come back and investigate it later. This is where the players find out that the Count isn't arriving till the next day. And so they've still got this recipe for, it's not quite a cure. I guess it's a form of a vaccine. It's like a herbal tincture that you can whip up that will stop the plague from spreading. It will suppress the symptoms of it. It won't fully cure it. And they decide, okay, well, while we're here, maybe we can start putting together this tincture. And another bit of information that they find out is that there is a sort of prominent herbalist in the area. Seneth Sarhand is the proprietor of the city's only herbalist shop, this unassuming business, but he stocks all manner of magical herbs. So they buy the ingredients and they start sort of putting together this tincture after they've taken note of the merchant's ship. And then when they come out, they find that there is a centaur who has bought a cart, like a cart full of wine casks for some party. And his cart is blocking the street and he's having this encounter with a city guard who's sort of hassling him. And I'm already eating my words because this is the one time it's not Morgarath in disguise. This is just sort of a side plot point that will come back later. This is like laying the foundation for something that'll come up a little later in this adventure.
The exception proves the rule, blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah, blah. So they have this encounter where they talk down the city guard from giving the centaur any trouble. The centaur is allowed to go on his way, and they've made an ally with this sort of the centaur who is putting together a big party for his centaur friends, and he invites them along. Hulka is delighted by this. The other sort of key timed events that go on while they are there, there's one where there's a street preacher, and he is preaching about how the plague has been spreading and invoking the name of Istis, the priest of Istis is berating the townsfolk for their inactivity, saying they should make sure to close the gates and expel all those who are not from Jern to make sure that the plague stays outside their walls. Again, it all sounds like a little too prescient, right? And so a crowd is gathering, listening to this street preacher basically say, like, you know, we got to shut down the city before the plague gets here. We've been lucky so far, but we won't be lucky forever if we keep letting people in and out. And so the players sort of take note of this political unrest. At a different point in time, they discover a rat that is looking really sick. Stash is noticing all sort of these animal things that are going on. There's a rat that looks really sick that they see on the street. And Stash actually took the rat. I didn't expect her to, but she took the rat and started caring for it and used it kind of like a test subject for the tincture that they're making. And they managed to keep the rat from becoming totally sick, but they do confirm that this rat is infected with the Red Death. So the Red Death is making its way to Jern. And at this point, you know, time passes. And we get to the day where that afternoon the Count will be returning to Jern. And it's on this day that Morgarath decides to really step up messing with the players. So first, Morgarath takes the form of this female halfling, and she stumbles against the players, just sort of passing up against them in a street, and uses this moment to try and actually infect one of the players with the Red Death using the plague wand. But Morgarath fails. The players catch on as this is going down and they go like, wait a minute, we know that wand, like something is amiss. And so this halfling just runs off and disappears into the crowd. The players give chase and a chase scene ensues, including a moment from the module where Morgarath gets the high ground, starts shooting at them with a crossbow, and as they sort of dodge the shots and get closer, they see Morgarath transform into the form of a raven and fly away. And so instantly they're like, okay, we've got like some sort of shapeshifter.
I was about to say, ah, Dangus, the Cymbeline sold the plague wand to some halfling. Then things just escalate. It's like, oh, Dangus, the halfling was a raven.
Yeah, exactly. So at this point, they sort of go like, we've got a shapeshifter on our tail. Like there's someone who can change shape who is trying to disrupt our plans or take us out. And they give chase, and between Stash's abilities, this I should also note that in the module, even though I wasn't doing the class focus things, because the way the module is laid out is each quest focuses on a different class, and based on how the players handle that mission, like there's a big change to each class of character that goes on. But because the party did not have one of each member of each class in it, I sort of forewent that part. But this is the druid focused one, so there's a lot of like animal stuff, and it was a real time for Stash to shine. So using her familiar and just her own sort of animal sensing instincts as a druid, Stash is able to...
Is Stash a druid?
Druid rogue.
Okay. For some reason, I thought she was a sorceress.
No. Anyway. No. Druid rogue. Yeah, oddly, there are no spellcasters in this party.
Honestly, I guess it's just because, like, Chaos Sorcerer seems like such a fit for, like, sometimes swap brains with my squirrel.
Right, yeah.
Druid's a spellcaster, but, like, no pure spellcaster?
Yeah, that's right. No wizards, no sorcerers. A druid and a paladin are the closest you get. And I guess the ranger has, like, one or two magic abilities, but not much. But, yeah, so Stash is able to catch up with the raven as it flies into some decorative gardens. And so the players run into the gardens, and Stash uses her talk to animals to talk to, like, the ducks in the pond, talk to the animals around the garden, and they all point the way, saying, the raven arrived here and then changed shape into an otter and got in the stream and, like, swam downstream into the river that is up against the edge of Jern. And so the players... went down to the river's edge. They can't see the otter. They've effectively, like, lost their quarry. But they decide that what they're going to do is they're going to cross the river and see maybe something on the other side will tip them off. Maybe they'll be able to pick up this is where they start calling Morgarath the animal man. Maybe they'll be able to catch up with the animal man on the other side. And so they just catch a raft to the other side. They arrive on the other side of the river, and they start spreading out and searching for the animal man, searching for Morgarath. And they don't find him, but what they find instead are, like, while they're looking around, they can hear the sounds of merriment from nearby. And they happen upon the place where the centaur, who they met before, and all his centaur buddies, they're building a big bonfire. And that evening, they're clearly going to be having, like, basically a big cookout and summer party, celebrating the...
They're going to have a freaking super spreader event.
Yeah, basically, they're going to have a super spreader event. But Hulka is not one to turn down the party. To turn down the opportunity to party. So she convinced the group, she's like, why don't we stay here? You know, we can relax with these centaurs, and we're right on the road into town. There's a road coming from the north that the Count is no doubt going to be taking to the ferry landing to cross the river and get back to Jern. So why don't we chill here, and maybe we can catch up with the Count while he comes down the road? And so they hang out with the centaurs and make friends with a lot of them as they party. And as it gets into the afternoon, they decide to sort of check it out. And sure enough, keeping an eye on the road nearby, they can spot the Count's carriage coming down the road. And as they watch, there is an ambush from Morgarath. He ambushes the Count's carriage, shooting a couple of the guards and just like generally causing chaos. Morgarath has a lot of spells and like magical abilities. And so they intervene, and the sort of concluding portion of this session before they even really got to meet the Count is they rescue him from the ambush. They intervene, they fight Morgarath like at range. Morgarath used only sort of ranged attacks. And then as soon as the players were getting close to like actually dealing some damage to him, he changed shape again to a bird and flew away. And the players were extremely frustrated by it. But it concluded with the Count thanking them. And that was sort of where it drew to a close. It was sort of like they meet the Count, and he goes like, you know, what the hell was that? And Morgarath got away again.
So, what, like a weekend in Jern? Just like a day, I guess, eh?
No, it's like 2 days. They spend like 2 days in Jern.
Seems pretty eventful.
Yeah, a very eventful couple of days, and they'll be there for at least one more day as they talk to the Count and try to convince him to use his healing amulet for a greater good.
Any further adventures in Jern after this, or are they going to be moving on pretty promptly?
I'll have to check my notes, but I think they have one more adventure here before they move on. This is a real, like, road trip of a campaign, though. They go all over the place. And I'll have to, at some point, I'll have to post the map that I kept, because I got a map of Greyhawk, and I would do, like the pins on the map thing, where I noted down where they went throughout the campaign, and it's quite a spotted map at this by the time it concluded.
Awesome. Yeah, I guess I was just wondering, like, is it the sort of thing where they have one adventure per stop, or
in the module, they do have only one adventure per stop, but I wanted to sort of stretch it out a bit more, so I would pepper in these other little side tracks wherever they went.
So, from the world of Greyhawk to the realm of the Nightside Eclipse, Citra Arha, suspended in the far realms outside of time and space to enable coordinated invasions of multiple planes and different dimensions. This is Operation Abysmal Airships. Is the first adventure within Citra Arha after the players get into Citra Arha proper after passing through the sort of gate realm of Nespeith. And this operation I used as like inspiration and to harvest for material. I used the Dungeons and Dragons expedition for the Adventurers League Season 2, Episode 2, Embers of Elmwood. I know that it's basically about a settlement has burned down and it's because of the fire cult, but like all that really made it into my version of this is that just like there's fires and there's like fire monsters and stuff, but we'll get into that. You'll see why and the explanation for that. But yeah, Embers of Elmwood. This takes place in Worships, which is the first realm of Citra Arha that the players find themselves venturing to once they get in. We sort of covered this last time as like they got in by escorting a red wizard who was there on as a guest to the Nightside Eclipse. But then once they passed through the gates, they had sort of more free rein to travel within the network of Citra Arha. And last episode, I included a picture of the sort of weird map of the Citra Arha network, which we'll include in the Compare and Campaign WordPress. But also, that is like that map is also the bizarre sigil that is tattooed on Ara Kendor's face, which is now also like indicating where they are based on like which part of his tattoo appears to be glowing.
And so it's that album cover by Portal, right?
Yes. And the other thing that I was going to say about that is that that sigil on that album cover, that album is Swarth by Portal, and it has 8 tracks, and the sigil is an octagon, so each of the realms of Citra Arha that are represented by the points on the exterior of that octagon are named after the 8 tracks of that album, and they form a sort of like clock of realms.
Cool.
That are like
so
the various realms of Citra Arha.
So that means that there is a track called Worships?
Yes.
Nice.
Worships, if you're looking at the map, you can see is sort of in like the 8 o'clock position. Worships, I mean, the thing about Citra Arha, and this was something that I was thinking about a lot and like actually doing a bit of research to help me articulate, is like how to describe Citra Arha to a listener. One thing that occurred to me is like, because one comparison that I make a lot is that it's like a space station. Is like, you know, you have that sort of octagonal network with the various points connected in the middle, connected by sort of like these lines that are like, can be thought of as like corridors. And if you think of it as being like a space station suspended in the sort of void of the Far Realms, then you can sort of see how it's like, you can imagine like an orbital space station in that sort of shape of that map being just sort of like various modules connected by corridors. But the reason I had to do some sort of research about this was because that doesn't really convey the magnitude of Citra Arha. And I wanted to say, so the thing I was researching is like, how big was the Death Star supposed to be? And like, there's sort of some conflicting information about it I found, and like, there's a lot of things. It's like, well, there's the Death Star, and then there's the second Death Star, which is even bigger. But like, it was also like, initially it got in my head because it's like, they say it's too big to be a space station. It must be a moon. And then I'm like thinking like our moon, like Earth's moon. And apparently it's smaller than that. But like, if even the thing is, I think even in like whatever size the Death Star was, it's so huge that if you really think about it, like if there was, say, like, the elevators were all locked down, like you could potentially spend like more than one day just like ascending levels of the Death Star to get from one place to another. Like, do you ever think about that?
Just like, you mean just how huge the Death Star actually is, supposedly?
Well, how huge it is, and like how, like putting that into perspective, like the idea of like, if you had to walk from one part of the Death Star to the other, like it would be like walking from one side of a city to another. It would probably be bigger. Like it's something that would take you not just hours, but like potentially days. And
it just makes me think of Spaceballs, right?
The thing is, I've seen Spaceballs, but I can't remember what is relevant here.
Oh, okay. So the joke at the beginning, the very beginning of Spaceballs, is that the grand flagship of the Spaceball fleet, Spaceball One, is enormous. Like, it's ridiculously big. And the first joke of the movie is that the spaceship flies by the camera, and then it's like 5 minutes of just the spaceship creeping by the camera because it's so huge. And then near the end, when they hit the self-destruct sequence on the spaceship, the voiceover goes like, self-destruct initiating soon. And then it lists everything that is in Spaceball 1, where it's like, close all the shops in the mall, evacuate all animals in the zoo, and just like goes through this lengthy list of everything that is on this giant ship.
Yeah, basically, like I think that's the right idea. Like, it's also like, man, I was just getting staggered looking up the other day, like what the population of a Star Destroyer is, like comparing it to like the Enterprise D, which I thought was huge and had a lot of people on it. And then Star Destroyer is supposed to have like a million people on it. Like, it's so crazy. There's like 30,000 officers or something like that.
Yeah, anyway, when you start thinking about it on that level, you really start going like, okay, but who is more evil, the Rebellion or the Empire? Because yeah, the Empire blew up Alderaan, but then how many Star Destroyers did the Rebellion, like, who has the higher kill count really? Stormtroopers can't hit the broadside of a barn.
That doesn't bother me so much as, like, what I'm really trying to highlight here is, like with a Star Destroyer having that many people on it, like it would be the numbers of crew and the sizes in Star Wars imply, on the Imperial level, imply, like, a level of logistics that is basically impossible to fathom. Like talking about like stowing away on an Empire vessel, or posing as a stormtrooper. It's like no one would have any idea if you were part of the crew or not, because it's like, yeah, there's a million people on this vessel. I have no idea if this guy's legit or not. Like, it would be so hard to coordinate. Like I was thinking about this, and like the levels of administration on the Death Star would border on like regional. Like the coordination between people would be like the coordination between people in neighboring cities rather than like that of like two dudes working on the same station or something. And like basically, right, all this to say that like I like when you see Star Wars A New Hope and you see them in the Death Star, it doesn't convey that size at all. It feels like a very small place where it's easy to get from one place to another. Like, yeah, that is my read of it. It's like,
well,
it takes them so little time to get to the captive they need to rescue, to the like bay to escape again, relative to how huge that place must have been and how much space you would have to cover to get from one place to another, especially places that should logically be far apart, like the detention center and the escape. But the reason that this specifically, this sort of phenomenon of seeing it and it feeling smaller, is that I feel like I ended up creating this same sort of impression where, to Al's Aces, when they went to Citra Arha in this act for the first time, they got through that gate area of Nespeith, and then they were traveling so directly from place to place within this, like, as I've described it, kind of like space station outside of time and space, that it felt like that with the Death Star, where it's like, well, it doesn't, the magnitude of it wasn't necessarily conveyed because it was just like they were just going from point to point, and like I wasn't really fleshing out for them just how much they were seeing. It was mainly just like you're going through corridors and stuff and you're following travel routes to get to a place.
Well, I think the thing is, it's kind of impossible to avoid that with Dungeons and Dragons, because for one thing, each session has a limited time frame. And so you want to sort of skip the boring bits and get right to the action. So anytime players are in like a giant space, you don't go through every step of it. Be like, you pass through a door, you're in another giant room. It takes you 15 minutes to walk to the other end of the room. You find the next door, you open it. Beyond that is a corridor. You spend 20 minutes walking down the corridor. It's more like you navigate your way through the facility until you find room X. But that can really skip over the actual scale of the thing that you're trying to convey.
So it's funny because this is really relevant to something we talked about recently, where like what you just said is basically my take on the Isle of Labyrinth. It's like, if there's, you know, the
right,
them wandering the maze of the Isle of Labyrinth was secondary to them getting to the points where the action was happening.
But see, in the case of something like the Isle of Labyrinth, though, I feel like you don't have to sort of go through the motions of describing everything. But if you presented them with a map that was a maze, that itself would sort of become like a mini game, you know, like when you're like, if you find a maze on a child's placemat and you know, or on the back of a cereal box and you take the time to solve it, it's not going to take forever, but it sort of becomes its own little mini game in that regard.
So the thing about Citra Arha is that since this act, in the campaign that I'm currently running, I ran another act set in Citra Arha. And, like, I think seeing the like it would be a very, something of a revelation to, if you were, like, if this was, like, a series and you were in the audience and you had seen Citra Arha as it appeared in, like, the second series in Hal's Aces, you'd think, like, you would think of it as being like a space station, and you'd think of it more the way we think of the Death Star when we think of it in A New Hope, which is not like, you know, some epic Lord of the Rings-esque journey that you have to go through of this massive artificial planetoid. It's just like, it's an adventure. It's like a dungeon crawl, basically. And that's like maybe how you would think about Citra Arha. But in this later act, they traveled through Citra Arha, and the magnitude was so much more apparent to them, because the travel for them was more like, it was less like traveling through corridors from place to place, and it more became like traveling from realm to realm of Citra Arha became like sailing from island to island in a big cluster. And the fact is that Citra Arha is like both. It's basically like, if you think of that huge space station, you need to think of each realm of it as being like the size of its own sort of island, and having like sort of a huge structure to it that can have, you know, thousands upon thousands of undead and units within it. But basically, I just wanted to highlight, like this is sort of the best comparison I can give, is it's like a space station, but it's so huge that, like, don't think of it like the ISS space station. Think of it like the Death Star. Think of it like a space station that's so huge that, like, there could literally be different regions in it with different administrators that are sort of coordinating as if it's its own, like, country or something. So hopefully that gives the right idea of, like, what Citra Arha is like as a place.
Sounds pretty big.
Beyond everything. I mean, yeah, that, and just like the idea that it is this network of like modules, but those modules are realms in and of them, like realms unto themselves, and each one is ruled by like a lich within the Nightside Eclipse, which is then under the Omni Lich, which rules from like the central area in Sitra Ara. So when they get to Worships, immediately the place that they start checking out, because they're basically here on like a scouting slash like an intel gathering, but also a potentially a sabotage mission, like they're trying to map things out. And so what they discover in Worships is a like processing lab. Basically, we had seen back when they were in Nespeith, sort of outside the gates of Sitra Arha proper, they had dealt with some undead who were like engaged in like an amateur processing attempt, where basically they created a pod and they were like trying to drain the life force of a victim, like without the help of the greater system of the Nightside Eclipse, so that they could get the benefits of it just like directly themselves rather than the greater system. But here the players found like a lab where the actual thing was done by like the Nightside Eclipse as part of the system. And this was like an immediate sort of thing where it's like, okay, they've got a victim here, and like this is how they sort of add undead to their system. So this is definitely like intel that we should be collecting. We should be finding out as much about this process as possible. And if possible, we should also like shut it down and sabotage it. One thing that is really that I think is important to bring up now that I'm not sure I've talked about before is the lowest level within the Nightside Eclipse. I think this may have been something that I actually established in this specific adventure. Is something that has been like really crucial to the Nightside Eclipse ever since, is the idea of Nightside Eclipse drones. And Nightside Eclipse drones are basically like, you know, I've talked about how the Nightside Eclipse hierarchy is like Omni Lich at the very top, Liches below that, Vampires below Liches, but still in a leadership position. But then as you go down, you start to see like, you know, Death Knight, White, you know, Ghoul, etc., like Ghost, all the undead. So you get to the bottom where it's just like skeletons and zombies. But then at the very bottom are drones. And drones are just like, they have effectively the least amount of like autonomy and initiative. They are they're very kind of robot like. The other, I guess the only other time I've really mentioned this concept is in talking about when they experimented with the cannabis corpse cannabis, they found that there was like a sort of mentally dampening effect that it could have, that like you would turn into sort of like more of a sluggish kind of Nightside Eclipse drone. And so drones are like, they're below zombies and skeletons. They are not like combat units. They are just like your basic average Nightside Eclipse Joes that are just like basic labor. They're like the sort of like the slave cast of things. They do all the basic stuff, and they're basically, they just appear as like humanoids that are just like walking corpses, not like rotted or messed up the way zombies are, but they're just like, they're always super pale. They're always just kind of walking around. Again, kind of like androids or something. Like
they're kind of like the zombies that you find in an Italian zombie movie.
Yeah, I guess you could say that, but like
they're
they also
usually
like,
just
they don't
like
really
a person with gray skin.
Yeah, but also like none of the like zombie behavior or anything either. Like they kind of do the sort of like lurch thing, but like they are more, you know, like I say, basic laborers. They're not like gonna swarm you or anything so much as they're just going to like operate machines and stuff or computers within the Sitra Arha, for example.
So they're more like the androids in the later sections of Alien Isolation.
Yes, that is actually a good example. Yeah, the Working Joes. They do. I was also thinking of like the androids as they appear, like the bad androids that they made in Picard.
Oh my god!
Not that that's really worth bringing up, but like you the know, less they, said they about sort it, of the fit better. That description.
Oof.
Now, although it should also be said that like the thing about the drones, like I guess I can say as a DM that like the mechanical role that they fill is that like, you know, there's any number of, say I'm doing one of these Adventurers League adventures and I'm using it as the basis for an operation and there's all sorts of monsters and stuff and it's like, okay, whatever this monster is, I'll turn it into something that makes sense for my game. And so like, you know, there's say some sort of like mercenary, it's like, okay, I'll turn him into like a special Knights at Eclipse, one of those Autumn Leaf agents, for example. But if the module says that there's just like a commoner with like no attack ability and just like 10 HP or something, that's a drone. That's drones, baby. That's what drones are for. Is your basic, I also, other things that are popping in my head is like the Vortigaunts in Half-Life in the first one. It's like they're all around in Zen, but like they don't bother you if you don't bother them, you know? Just drones, man. Just doing the work. So the players enter this lab and they identify that there is this subject being monitored in this pod that is like scheduled for processing, and they're like, all right, we're going to investigate this. They manage to sort of like talk their way past the guards at the area. They're like, oh, we're these extraplanar mercenaries. They have the option as well, like, I've got all these notes, like they can try and bribe the guards or whatnot, you know. But also like no matter what, if they talk things out with this guard and resolve these things peacefully, 15 minutes later the guards will return and they will be hostile because they'll realize like, hey, what the hell's going on here? I feel like they generally went pretty hostile. I think that there was like a sense that things were gonna break bad eventually no matter what, so like while they tried to hold their cover for some amount of time, they eventually dropped it, to my knowledge, pretty quickly, as far as I remember. But one thing that I talked about before, so they begin basically like accessing, like, how to say this, like, because it wouldn't be, you know, there's, they're D&D heroes. They wouldn't be, like, hacking necessarily. I think literally, actually, what Chessie was doing was taking components of the weird Nightside Eclipse technology they were finding in Citra Arha and putting it into a bag of holding and then just, like, bringing back as much stuff as she could for examination upon return to the MPOC. And so it's like, it's not the sort of thing where like they hacked into the pod or anything, but they just started like grabbing important components. They tried to stop the process and like extract the prisoner from the pod, which I think they did successfully. But the thing is that, and this was sort of foreshadowed back when they were in Nespeith and they dealt with the amateur processing, but when they prevented that situation, the thing ended up like malfunctioning and like starting a fire. And the same thing happens here, where basically a fire breaks out in the lab because of their like interference with the subject's pod, which leads to the sort of Nightside Eclipse guard staff, like security staff of this lab, all like start rushing to the monitor lab to assault the place. So they end up in this like big sort of like this, they end up sort of having to hold their ground within this like Nightside Eclipse Science Complex, fighting their way through like all these security guys showing up. There were some undead like attack dogs that were wearing special armor called Rot Hounds. And there were also a bunch of different like actual sort of like little robotic hovering drones that deployed throughout the station, some of it which were actually like fire suppression drones that were there to like take care of the emergency. Other ones were security drones. But it's funny because all of these were like, this got to like show off the sort of like technological elements of the Nightside Eclipse within their station. Like they have this advanced technology because in their world they like rose to complete supremacy before moving on to this whole extraplanar endeavor. So they have this really intensely advanced technology, which includes all these little robotic drones that deploy here. But for each of these drones, the stat line was actually based on like a Mephit or a Magman, for example. Like I think it's a smoke Mephit. One of the Mephits was like the extinguisher Mephit, basically, and was like had a burst attack. Right. It's the one that their attack, their breath attack or whatever, doesn't do damage. It just blinds, basically, and that was basically like a fire extinguisher attack. So they end up fighting through this like science facility on high alert. They are informed that the lab is going to self-destruct in 5 minutes, but overall that's like 50 rounds if you're going in a 5e combat. So just sort of like, you know, the lab is self-destructing, the enemy security is closing in. Another thing that they ran in, another type of like weird unit that I used was the monster listed was fire snakes, but what I had were these weird sort of like living electrical cables that like came out and attacked them like sort of like snake bot drones. So they and like the place is catching fire and continuing to burn as they are escaping, which is mostly what I took from the module that this was based on, apart from like the stat lines. But eventually they managed to escape, escorting the subject with them, the one that they rescued from the pod. Although it was in the subject was in like a, you know, basically a sort of comatose state. Having already, like, they already got to be dead in order to be turned into one of the Nightside Eclipse undead. So basically they're carrying around like a sort of like weird half-resuscitated, almost undead corpse. But the point is that they've like extracted the subject for study potentially. The other thing is that then, like, as they're escaping that one part of the lab where they extracted the subject from, they then pass into a corridor where they make their way to a chamber that branches off of it that is, like, basically a Citra Arha data hub. And these, like, this was a place where the sort of computer system of Citra Arha was advanced enough to be that sort of, like, very intuitive touch interface that you see in like sci-fi a lot, where it was, you know, more plausible that was like, okay, the characters don't have to like type any codes in or hack or anything. They just need to like try and interface with this terminal, and then they are able like quickly glean information from it. And so this was where they finally for the first time got access to the map of Citra Arha, a list of its personnel, including like the liches that were in charge of each realm in Citra Arha, and the different vampires on the security personnel, which included a lot of profiles of deceased vampires, included from the ones that had been killed previously, or missing in action vampires such as Lokash, who of course is in the Crimson Chambers right now. But basically, they, you know, same thing as I was saying with Chessie before. She just, like, grabs as much as possible. So they just, like download a bunch of data, as it were. But then, like, the real point is that she, like, grabs all the data drives out of the machine. Another fun point is that, like, since she was literally just, like grabbing everything she could and putting it into her bag of holding, there were things that she brought back to MPOC after this act, like a chair from Citra Arha. There was just, like, a big metal chair. It's like a command chair or something that she just, like, grabbed and put in the bag of holding in case it would be useful data in any way. And while they were in that data hub, before continuing their escape, they found there was a series of lockers in the room as well that they were able to break into, which included there were some, like, weird encrypted Nightside Eclipse data slates, which, again, benefit is that they don't need to know how to decrypt them themselves. They can just bring this all back to MPOC and hope that they figure it out with time. But they also found a magic item among these lockers, which was a Staff of Charming, which is a staff that lets you cast spells such as Charm Person and the like. But the real reason I mention it is because it is still in the MPOC armory. It's one of the magic items that nobody really kept. Chessie already had, you know, her Staff of Defense, her... like web wand, her sword, her spider climb, slippers, all that stuff. Nobody really needed a Staff of Charming. So, you know, eventually when they got back to Drail in the MPOC, they just, you know, put it into the armory. And it's one that MPOC agents can still to this day withdraw from the armory for the rental fee of 3,000 gold. And, yeah, so then they managed to get the map of Citra Arha, data cube. With the map, they are now, you know, a little bit better off in Citra Arha since they can sort of determine where they are going. And they escape from Worships, but just as they were, like, making their final escape into the sort of, like, maintenance tunnels of the station, as it were, hot on their heels was the Lich Lord of, I think it actually might be a vampire lord in the case of Worships, but the Lord of Worships, which is a goblin, it's like a goblin vampire cyborg by the name of Rex, who has a robot arm and, like, a partially, like, robot cyborg face. He's like a goblin Borg vampire, basically. And he was hot on their heels with, like, a huge security force, which told them, like, you know, there was the clear idea among the players is, like, oh man, this is not a situation we're supposed to stand and fight. This is a situation where we're supposed to run. Like, just, we can read this, basically. And, so they made their escape from Worships in the nick of time. But also Rex, the goblin cyber vampire, is actually based on a character I ran in the last game of 4th edition I ever played in, wherein I played a goblin whose class was vampire, and later in the end, like, the sort of culmination of his character was that he joined a crazy vampire techno conspiracy in the crazy setting we were playing in.
I've remarked upon it before, but I really like how your campaign is this sort of blend of, like, technological and fantasy, I guess. Like, they're invading this, like, science facility in another dimension, but it's all still based in D&D. It's a neat flavor.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of... you know, what I ideally want, basically, is, like, I want to play Dungeons & Dragons, but I want to have no limits. I want to play that Rift style, you know, where you just can go anywhere and anything can happen.
Oh, yeah. But with a better system.
Yeah, that's the idea. So, that is that for our, adventure in Citra Arha. Tavern time! It's tavern time! I think that it's tavern time.
It is tavern time. I'm excited for tavern time, because...
Yeah, you had like a sudden, a breaking tavern pick? What's going on here?
Okay, so, as should be clear from the past few taverns that I've talked about, been on this kick, just like finding weird and obscure RPGs that I'd never heard of. This is what led us to Human-Occupied Landfill and Blue Planet, the one where everybody plays as like a psychic dolphin. And so I found a bunch of other ones that I was going to bring. There's one called Terrible RPG. There's one called All Out of Bubblegum. I'm going to talk about those on our next show, though, because I fell down a rabbit hole. One of the RPGs that I found in researching these that I'm going to talk about, this is the one that still made the cut, is an RPG called Abort, Retry, Fail. You ever heard of this?
I don't think so.
So Abort, Retry, Fail, it is a really, it's like a one-page RPG system, and all of the players, like each player takes control of a subroutine in a Terminator. So each player takes control of a rogue subroutine, attempting to complete the mission to the best of their limited abilities, while also accomplishing a nonsensical goal foisted on them by their malfunctioning programming. So together, your players all pilot a single Terminator through 1984 to try and complete a mission. This is a small, minimalist D6 game for three or more players with light GM duties, focused on madcap comedy and one-liners. A good game to warm up your role-playing muscles before a real session, or just waste an hour or so doing Arnold Schwarzenegger impressions. I thought that sounded pretty funny. The idea of, it's almost like that game Space Team. Like, everybody has a single subroutine that they control inside a Terminator robot, and everyone has to work together within their limited means to complete the Terminator's mission. Sounds pretty funny,
it's
right?
It's also, it reminds me of that one I told you about in a previous episode, Everyone is John?
Yeah. Yeah, Everyone is John is what led me to this, in fact. I was looking for RPGs like Everyone is John. Weird RPGs, specifically. And there is a sequel to Abort, Retry, Fail. It's called Abort, Retry, Fail 1000. Whereas the first Abort, Retry, Fail is set in Los Angeles in 1984, like the first Terminator, the sequel is set in Los Angeles 1991. And in this case, the machine that everybody is controlling with the weird subroutines is a liquid metal robot. So this time you're piloting the T-1000.
I knew it!
Yep. Though thematically similar, this game utilizes a different set of mechanics to create a more competitive atmosphere with greater emphasis on encouraging poor decision-making among players and coming up with madcap actions to pad out your plans. So I found these two games, Abort, Retry, Fail and Abort, Retry, Fail 1000. And I was going to talk about them and some other ones. But then I noticed, I found these on, these are Pay What You Can on DriveThruRPG. I noticed at the bottom of one of the entries for Abort, Retry, Fail, there was an icon with Arnold Schwarzenegger's face on it and says, I'll be back. And I look closer and it says, this game is part of the I'll Be Back collection, a series of small games about everyone's favorite bodybuilding actor slash governor. So I click on it, and here's the I'll Be Back collection. This is what I'm talking about this time. It is six games, and they are all themed after Schwarzenegger movies. We've covered two of them. Here's one called Soviet Method. This is based on the Schwarzenegger movie. It doesn't say it. Well, it's the one with Belushi. Red Heat. Red Heat. So Soviet Method is a story game about over-the-top crime fighting and ridiculously violent methodology common to cinema. In this one, you use a deck of cards as prompts for witnesses and suspects. The pseudo-GM role, that is the American cop, sets the scene, and then the various players control the Soviet cop to compel him to various levels of violent action in an attempt to mill the deck and pin the crime on one of the face cards. It's a game of one-upmanship that encourages players to come up with excessive, nonsensical bullshit, egg each other on, and have a good laugh. I think that sounds pretty fun. These are all like just light-hearted, like single-page RPG-style games that seem like just fun to pick up and play. Here's another one. This one is called To Hell With You. And this one is based on Conan the Barbarian. An evil sorcerer king took you as a slave and strapped you to the Wheel of Pain alongside other teenaged barbarians, condemned to turn the wheel pointlessly until your death. There's no way out, except to push the wheel harder than anyone else. Eat those who fall behind to gain their power and become jacked enough to escape by Crom. To Hell With You is a story game about bravado. Each player tells increasingly over-the-top tales of their barbaric might to turn the wheel faster and faster, hopefully overrunning the weak until there is but one left to take their revenge. So this is like a game of one-upmanship. And then, for these last two, because they are, the titles are quotes directly from the movies that they are referencing, I'm sure you can figure out what they are. At least this first one, this game is called One Ugly Motherfucker.
Predator.
Yeah. This is a story game that recreates the tale of Predator. A special forces team is whittled down one by one as they try to accomplish the mission. As each player plays as a member of the special forces team, and as each dies, they become an aspect of the hunter and turn on their comrades. When only one is left, the tables are turned, and the hunter becomes the hunted. So it's almost like one of those like werewolf-style games, where everybody is being... It starts off where there's only like one enemy, and then as people get picked off, they join the enemy, and finally the tables... The balance has tipped until there's only one player left who's still human, basically. And then finally, this one's trickier. It's called Unbelievable Macho Bullshit. Here's the tagline. Remember when I said I'd kill you last? I lied.
Is it Commando?
It is Commando.
Okay.
So Unbelievable Macho Bullshit is an oppositional role-playing party game. Another single-page game.
Man, where's my last action hero game?
It's not here, but, you know, they better make one. I don't see why not. They've made six so far. So Unbelievable Macho Bullshit is an oppositional role-playing party game. Each player plays a villain in an evil organization, which is being rapidly disassembled by an unstoppable hero in a hail of bullets and one-liners. Your best bet to survive just a little longer is to try and foist the oncoming storm onto one of your compatriots. It's swift, silly. It plays faster the more people you have. It's a great warm-up or random game and a good way to let off some steam. So this is the I'll Be Back collection of RPGs. I'm going to pick them all up because they all sound like they'd be good for a laugh. And I appreciate that they're not just, like, all riffs on the same system. Like, I really like that, that you know, some of them are competitive. Some of the, Abort, Retry, Fail, you gotta work together. But Unbelievable Macho Bullshit, you gotta work against each other. Wheel of Pain is about puffing yourself up with arrogant stories. And then Soviet Method uses, like, a deck of cards. It's really cool. I gotta say, really like how varied these are. They all seem pretty fun.
Whole lot of inspiration from one guy's wacky career.
Yeah, and so I'll have more crazy RPGs to talk about next time, but I got completely sidetracked by the I'll Be Back collection on DriveThruRPG. What do you got?
Hey, McGill, name a Dungeons & Dragons monster.
A beholder.
Okay, name a... Hold on. Yeah, okay, you know something? Know something crazy?
I picked the wrong one.
Well, no, you picked the right one, because wasn't one of the original D&D monsters. That's what I'm talking about today. What were the original D&D monsters? Name another D&D monster.
Rust monster.
Rust monster. I don't see it here.
The original D&D monsters. We're talking pre-first edition?
This is like the first edition, like OD&D, original Dungeons and Dragons, the 1974 one.
And I'm trying to guess one of the originals.
I mean, so far you've got Beholder isn't one, and Rust Monster isn't one. I'll tell you another one, because it was relevant a few minutes ago. Lich is not one.
What about a goblin?
Goblin is the first one listed.
That's right. If we're going all the way back to the very beginning of D&D, it's got to be really generic fantasy monsters, I bet. Like a dragon, right?
Well, of course, a dragon's in Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, hey, you know, it might not have been listed as a monster, though. Might have been a race or something that you could only use as an NPC, not necessarily as an enemy. You never know. Let me see if I can
get
another one.
I will say something I learned the other day was the first time that non-lethal damage as a concept was introduced to Dungeons and Dragons, or the idea of like subduing your opponent rather than killing them, was introduced as a special rule for dealing with dragons by capturing them instead of killing them.
See, this is what I'm talking about. We can't assume anything. We can't take any of these things for granted. What about a unicorn?
Unicorns are in the original.
That's right. Gotta go for
here,
the...
Here, let
the...
me hit you with a few.
Sure.
Were gnolls in the original?
I'm going to go with no.
They were.
Really?
And they were a cross between gnomes and trolls, otherwise similar to hobgoblins.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. What about bugbears? They in there?
I don't think so.
Oh, interesting.
Nope. No bugbear. It's funny because I literally have a written list of all of these, but every time I look, I have to like control F on the page where I have the list just to make sure I didn't forget, because it seems so insane that like a bugbear would be missing.
Or like, what about an orc? I'm guessing orcs are there, monster,
yeah,
rather than a race, right?
Orcs are there, yes. What about a purple worm?
I'm going to say no, but it's probably in there, isn't it?
It is in one of the originals. The purple
weird
worm.
How about, here's one, how about a rock?
A rock is there, and it's one of the interesting ones that stands out to me. It's, you know, not as common
you know,
as
you know,
ones.
But you know what I'm doing, Tom, right? You know why I'm getting these?
Because they're, like, from mythology and stuff?
From Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yeah?
Yeah, Lord of the Rings.
One thing that's funny is that all the, like, classic slimes appeared in the original. From ochre jelly to black pudding to green slime to gray ooze to yellow mold. They're all there.
Gelatinous cube?
No gelatinous cube. No, that's the one that's missing.
That's so funny because it's like one of those trademark D&D monsters is the cube.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, how many others have we named that are basically like beholders? Man, beholders weren't around?
Yeah, very true. Vampires?
Vampires were around.
Interesting. Yeah, the key to this is just to go for like the generic monsters. What about like Ghost? Is Ghost on the list?
We got Spectres.
Okay, or like Banshee?
I don't think we have Banshee, no.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Oh, Minotaur.
Minotaur is there.
Yeah.
You know what? Something.
I'm on to you, Gary Gygax. I know your secrets. Well,
let me list some ones that I think are real standouts to me.
Okay.
That like among the ones that are more obvious, like, you know, we've got all the undead ones. We've got Cockatrice, Basilisk, Medusa, Gorgons, Manticores, you know, Hydras, Chimeras, Wyverns. That all tracks. Oh, mm-hmm. There are four types of lycanthrope described. What do you think they are?
Okay. Werewolf.
Yeah.
We're boar.
Yeah.
We're rat.
No.
Oh, interesting.
Exactly, right?
Yeah. Were-rat's like one of the classic ones for D&D. Gosh, and two more. A were-cat?
Close.
Like a were-panther?
It's a were-tiger.
Were-tiger. Sort of classic. Got it. And there's one more.
There's one more.
It's a... Gosh, a weird goat.
Nope, it's a werebear.
Well, werebear, you know, I should have guessed that werebear.
One. One thing that's neat, if only because it's not in Dungeons and Dragons, or like it's not a standout monster manual entry in a lot of editions, I find nowadays, is you see Pixies is here, of course. But Nixies was in the original Dungeons and Dragons. Water sprites are neutral in nature, but will enslave humans for 1 year. Another one that I thought was really interesting, invisible stalkers were in the original Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, wow. A kind of an underrated monster. I don't even really use invisible stalkers much.
Man, invisible stalkers are great because they're basically predator. Like, man, if you want to deploy a Predator or Terminator in your game, let's put in those invisible stalkers. They absolutely will not stop ever until you are dead.
So besides Nixies, are there any on that list that, like, this is the only place they ever appeared?
I mean, Nixies have definitely appeared in other places. It's just, like, there are definitely, like... I don't think 5th edition Monster Manual had Nixies in it, for example.
But are there any on there that this is their only appearance?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think there's anything like that. We got goblins, kobolds, orcs, hobgoblins, gnolls, ogres, trolls, giants, skeletons, zombies, ghouls, wights, wraiths, mummies, specters, vampires, cockatrices, basilisks, medusae, gorgons, manticores, hydras, chimeras, wyverns, dragons, gargoyles, lycanthropes. And the only dragon types were white, black, green, blue, red, and gold. So the only metallic type was gold.
That makes sense. I remember back when I had my AD&D Monstrous Manual, they were Monstrous Compendium, rather. Pretty limited dragons.
I mean, mine always had... I've always known the set to have all the chromatic dragons and then all the metallic dragons. But this one only has one metallic dragon.
It's funny, as you go through this list, you can really perceive where it's like Lord of the Rings, and then Greek and Roman mythology, and then move into like sort of spooky European monsters or vampires. We've got specters, we've got werewolves. Is there a zombie on that list?
They're clearly like, what's that?
What about a zombie?
A zombie is present. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, and it's funny because they aren't grouped alphabetically in the book. They are grouped like you are reading them, basically. Like, it starts goblins, kobold, orc, hobgoblins, gnolls, ogres, trolls, giants, then skeletons, zombies, ghouls, wights, wraiths, mummies, specters, vampires, then cockatrice, basilisk, medusae, gorgons, manticores, hydras, chimeras, wyverns, dragons, gargoyles, lycanthropes, purple worms, minotaurs, centaurs, unicorns, nixies, pixies, dryads, gnomes, dwarves. Now we're in that sort of like woodland fae area. Elves, treants, pegasi, hippogriffs, rocks, griffins, invisible stalkers, elementals, djinn, ifrit, and your slimes. Ochre jelly, black pudding, green slime, gray ooze, and yellow mold.
I kind of like that.
So yeah, I just thought it was fascinating.
You can really detect somebody's brainstorming session going on.
Like, we need some like weird goo, right? Yeah, okay, well, let's come up with some weird goo.
Or just, you know, being like, we got through the Greek and Roman ones, Pegasus. Oh, and you know what else is like a Pegasus? How about a hippogriff? Yeah, a hippogriff. And
griffin and a rock. Birds, flying things.
Yeah, stuff that flies. Okay, we need more stuff that flies, right?
We need something that's just straight up invisible. Let's make something up.
An invisible... It's got to, like, stalk them, right? Invisible stalker.
Done. Call it a night. What does it do? Refrigerates things. Anyway,
I'm going on break.
Another classic, classic OG D&D. I thought that was really interesting stuff. The original monster list.
That's great.
So, like I said, this has been episode 70. It's been the 15th of July. If you want to get in touch with us or check out our regular posts, see when we post, when I update. Check us out on Facebook, Compare and Campaign on Facebook, or if you want to see our supplemental materials, aka show notes, all the stuff that we include, which is each of these episodes and whatnot, just check it out on compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. I don't know if I have much to share for the show notes for this episode. I can look through it, but I don't know if I've even got much doodles for this one, so we'll see. But
my contributions will be mostly I'll be back games.
Oh yeah, we'll have all those to show. But, you know, check us out on Compare and Campaign. And hey, the last episode did have the map of Citra Arha, so check that out. And until next time, don't steal, it's haunted.
Not me. Level up, get that ding.
All these things. Take care.